Who cares if it's children's theater? Margot is playing a criminal lawyer crusading for truth and justice. So would someone please tell her where, in what deranged fashion universe, a defense attorney would appear before a judge in a rainbow Harpo Marx wig and an obscenely short, hobblingly tight, iridescent purple suit. Margot arrives at the theater an hour early, since part of her preparation now involves a series of meditations designed to help her overcome the humiliation of squeezing into an outfit that her character, Portia McBailey, would never wear unless she'd quit being a lawyer and gone to work for an escort service, role-playing a slutty executive secretary birthday clown. Now, as she enters her dressing room before the Saturday matinee, she notices that the hem of the purple skirt has come entirely undone. The dimpled fringe of ragged cloth trailing clumps of thread will hypnotize the audience. Mommy, Daddy, why is that funny lady's skirt so hairy? Margot counts off 10 deep breaths so as to repel any negative thoughts that might otherwise collect around Lakshmi, the overworked, underpaid NYU Drama Department graduate student who is the costume department. Margot had volunteered a thrift shop treasure from the back of her own closet, an 80 Armani's pantsuit from her brief marriage to Enrico. It would have been perfect for Portia, but Roger had insisted on indulging his fetishistic attachment to the sleazy synthetic that morphs from violet to scarlet when it catches the light. Roger won. Roger is the director. Roger didn't threaten to have Margot replaced. Roger didn't have to threaten to have Margot replaced. Margot gave in to his blackmail, his mortifying demands, the fright wig, and the hooker suit. Not until the first time she walked out on stage and the audience burst out laughing did she understand what Roger had in mind. How many hours has Margot spent in her career practicing entrances and exits for a specific effect? Until now, mocking, childish hysteria was not an effect she'd gone for. But this is children's theater, not the freaking Merchant of Venice. The quality of mercy is not strained, it droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven. Margot memorized Portia's soliloquy when she was in high school. Now it's the quality of mercy is not strained, not even for a monkey. Lakshmi had lowered the hem twice as Margot requested, begged. In return, Lakshmi persuaded Margot to tone down the fuchsia lipstick, which along with her newly flaming pelt of spiky orange hair, she favors these days. Margot imagines Portia going for that look, confident, self-sufficient, but available, a brittle, protective, screw-you shell encasing a gooey caramel of longing. Really, Lakshmi had scrutinized Margot's lips, which the drugstore lipstick had turned a hypothermic purple. For Portia? So this is what it's come to. A note on her lipstick means that Margot is being taken seriously. She traded her drugstore night-blooming orchid for the Dior dusty pink, a chunk of that week's paycheck for which, like the rest of the cast, she feels absurdly grateful. They are in this together. Everyone is happy to be here and disappointed to be here. Glad to have a part in a play, glad to work for scale, but truthfully, not all that overjoyed to be working in an off-Broadway production of Mr. Monkey, the umpteenth hundred revival of a cheesy but mysteriously durable musical based on the children's classic novel. The actors and stagehands behave as if they've taken a blood oath not to complain, except for 12-year-old Adam, who whines because his monkey suit smells and he can't breathe. His stage mom, Giselle, has told everyone that if Adam develops health issues from asthma-causing dust mites, she'll sue. Only the interns are happy, as are Jason and Danielle, who have taken a break from the drama class to play the Jimson kids, the two motherless teenagers who have become Mr. Monkey's de facto siblings. By the end of the play, their widowed father, Mr. Jimson, marries Portia, the lawyer, that is, Margot. Jason and Danielle have no idea that Mr. Monkey the Musical is not the beginning of something, but rather the middle. Margot hopes it's the middle of something, that something being the bewildering stall into which Margot's life is circling. And what did Jason and Danielle imagine beginning when they couldn't learn their characters' names and missed so many cues that Roger changed their characters' names from whatever they were in the script to Jason and Danielle? Margot takes 10 more breaths, counting backwards, then does her vocal exercises, which her therapist, Dr. Reed, says is a form of Zazen meditation. The oxygen blast reminds her of what she tells herself at moments like this. Give everything. Self-doubt is lethal. Irony is poison. Every role you play with your whole heart and soul can be Ophelia, Juliet, Portia, Lady Macbeth. Well, maybe not Lady Macbeth. The great Carola Lester, Margot's acting teacher at Yale, used to say it was their job to be theatrical on and off stage. They must never forget that they are telling the stories of the tribe. Margot was the star, the one for whom the drama department had high hopes, and now she's Portia McBailey, representing a monkey. Margot prepared for Mr. Monkey as if for a real play. She'd worked out Portia's background, the successful legal career that has enabled her to take on cases and innocent monkey for fun. But the purple suit had forced Margot to reimagine Portia as a noble failure, lonely and slightly desperate, but consequently happier to meet and fall in love with Mr. Jimson, an attractive widower with two children. It had seemed like a lucky sign when, on the first day of rehearsal, Margot found in the garbage near her apartment on 6th and Avenue A a ton of 1950s law books, several of which she lugged to her dressing room. Carola had instructed them to surround themselves with objects their characters might collect. What will Margot do with the law books when Mr. Monkey closes? And what were they a lucky sign of? Some doddering lawyer retired or died in his storefront office in Alphabet City. Best case, a renovation. In a moment, she'll go find Lakshmi, but for now, Margot closes her eyes and runs through the great soliloquies in her head. Out, damn spot, Romeo, Romeo, the speech that most calms and inspires her, the 10 milligram Xanax of art. Is the heartbroken aria, which with Sonia wraps up the tragic misdirected love duets of Uncle Vanya. We shall go on living, Uncle Vanya. We shall live through a long chain of days and endless evenings. This part isn't supposed to be funny. I mean, go ahead. We will work for the happiness of others now and in our old age without rest, and we will die submissively as we have lived. Beyond the grave, God will know that we have suffered and wept, and he will pity us, and we will see a bright, beautiful life and rejoice and look back on our hard lives with tenderness and smile. Brave, disappointed, resigned to her fate, Sonia would know what it's like to play a lady lawyer in a musical for children age 5 to 12 and their parents' grandparents' birthday party and bar mitzvah guests, and on selected weekday afternoons for school groups offer tickets at a steep discount. That Margot's character is named Portia is one of the little jokes thrown in to keep the parents from poking their eyes out from boredom. Portia is the only lawyer willing to represent a beloved pet chimpanzee whose party trick is picking pockets. Mr. Monkey has been falsely accused of stealing the wallet from the Hermes, another mom and dad joke, bag of Mr. Jimson's evil girlfriend, Janice, who sees Mr. Monkey not only as a rival and threat, but as a banana-eating lower life form with filthy habits. Eleanor, who plays Janice, gets the Hermes, a plain black dress, long scarlet press-on nails, and her own naturally auburn hair. Eleanor's day job as an emergency room nurse has made it tricky to schedule rehearsals, an inconvenience that Roger has seemed inexplicably not to mind. Mr. Jimson is being played by a young actor named Eric, on whom Margot has a tiny, hopeless crush. Much too hopeless and much too tiny to hurt, as others have in the past. My unhappy love affair. Margot used to like describing men as my unhappy love affair. She only used it in the past tense. Alec or Jim or Enrico, he was my unhappy love affair. But hadn't that presumed the existence of a happy love affair that made the others seem unimportant? What if unhappy is the only kind Margot ever has? Mr. Jimson's two teenage children love Mr. Monkey. Their mom, Mr. Jimson's martyred wife, willed them the baby chimp whose parents were shot by poachers. She'd grown close to the chimpanzee couple before she too was killed in Africa, where she'd studied and defended endangered primates. After one rehearsal, Rogers showed the cast a documentary about heroic scientists and gamekeepers fending off the poachers and mercenaries hired by the oil company, which wants to destroy the wildlife and exploit the rich resources of the national parks. The film, which featured heart-rending footage of murdered animals, was supposed to inspire them, but it only depressed Margot more. Shouldn't they be doing something about this tragic situation instead of acting in Mr. Monkey? Mrs. Jimson, who is dead before the play begins, saw herself as Mr. Monkey's godmother, and so to her widower and kids, Mr. Monkey is more than a pet, more like an adopted son or brother. The children know that Dad's girlfriend Janice is trying to frame their goofy monkey sibling. Janice is pressing charges, and Mr. Monkey is being tried for larceny at taxpayer expense. Roger told the cast that the premise wasn't actually so far-fetched. Only 100 years ago, a dog was found guilty by a British court for having bitten a child and sentenced to be hung by the neck until dead. Danielle burst into tears, and Giselle, who came to every rehearsal, put her hands over Adam's ears and said, "At least the poor creature got a trial. Now the world's so crowded, they euthanize innocent puppies just for taking up space." Okay, so I'll skip a little bit. So Margot goes on stage. No, I'll read just a tiny bit more. Just yesterday, Eric came to Margot's dressing room and asked if she'd noticed anything strange about Roger. Maybe something about the show or about them, Eric smiled, had driven Roger over the edge. That Eric is shy, tall with a beautiful smile, and 10 years younger than Margot is not Eric's fault, nor is Eric to blame for the fact that he is not terribly bright. To feel grief and shame because Eric was asking her the way a kid might ask his older sister's opinion was a waste of the precious time that Margot was paying a fortune in therapy bills to learn to appreciate and value. No one in the cast tells Margot anything, no gossip, no rumors, nothing. But a week or so into the run, she ran into Eric and Rita in the hall. Rita plays Carmen, the passionate Latina housekeeper who refuses to accept the injustice being done to the monkey so beloved by the children she's cared for since their mother died. In the dimly lit, cramped, fire safety code violating corridor, Eric and Rita leaned over a sheet of paper. They were eager to show Margot the news item that Eric had found online and printed out, a story from South Africa about a chimpanzee which turned against its owner and ripped his face off because the guy refused to share the birthday cake he'd bought for another chimp. Eric and Rita were including Margot in a select club whose members would think this was hilarious, a cult that began when they'd watched Roger's film of the home assistance monkeys doing everything for their owners but program the DVR. If Margot didn't think that the murder monkey story was as funny as Eric and Rita did, it wasn't because she was a more sensitive, compassionate person, but because it was suddenly clear to her that they were sleeping together. Their laughter was so private, they could have been laughing at her. Margot needs to remember Rita's laugh in case she ever again in this lifetime gets cast as someone having sex with another human being. Monkey Tango, Orangutano, Urang, O Tango, King Kong, Congo, Mighty Joe Young, O Monkey Tango, Into the Jungle with Me. The tango is more like a square dance and just about as sexy. The cast forms couples and slide step across the stage with stiff tango arms, then switch partners and tango back, then line up facing the audience and do the monkey 1970s style, which amuses the grandparents and older parents. It isn't so much a performance as a final warning for the kids to quit wriggling in their booster seats, for the grandparents to unwrap the cough drops, for the tourist couples to check one last time that their cell phones are off, and for the parents to wonder if they can take a nap and still find their kids beside them when they wake up. No one but Margot is thinking about Margot's skirt. The song marks time. The applause is like a parting slap, reflexive and half-hearted, an afterthought as Portia and Carmen, lawyer and maid, skip together off stage. Back in her dressing room, Margot steps out of her skirt and hands it to Lakshmi, who goes off to fix it. Then Margot puts on the jeans she wore to the theater, sinks into the grimy corduroy recliner, and opens the letter. Somehow she'd known it would be anonymous, just as she'd known that it wouldn't be a death threat or a schizophrenic rant. The sheet of plain white paper is neatly folded in thirds. The typeface is soft, slightly blurred. The letters seem to have been typed on something like the hand-me-down IBM she used in middle school. She thinks of those antique detective stories in which forensic experts track the letter writer through the wear on the typewriter keys, ancient history, gone forever. On the page are three lines, single-spaced. Quote, "Failures and disappointments make time go by so fast that you fail to notice your real life. And the past, when I was so free, seems to belong to someone else, not myself. Anton Chekhov, from a letter to Maxim Gorky, January 3rd, 1899. It's the saddest sentence ever, the melancholy sweetness of it, and oh, the wrenching grief. And what an amazing coincidence. Margot was just thinking about Uncle Vanya, though, of course, as every artist, as every human being knows, there are no coincidences, but rather a river of mystical connections in which, from time to time, we are allowed to dip one big toe. Who knows why and how we are suddenly unable to draw from that stream flowing constantly around us. And when two people or two events enter that stream together, we, simple, unenlightened creatures who have no idea what else to call it or what it really means, we call it a coincidence. Thank you.